So, good evening. Good morning. We are continuing in this rather long chapter, Reality and the Cosmic Illusion. Sri Aurobindo has been exploring the nature of the experience that Shankara had and the philosophy that grew out of it. Knowledge and experience, he is in this last paragraph concluded, must converge in a suprarational status for us to have a sense of what it is that the universe would mean to the divine. The universe must not be incomprehensible to innate being, however confusing it might be to divided being. With a limited ken, K-E-N, we can only understand part of what the divine presents in the finite form of universe. With a limited knowledge, we can't see far. We can't see vastly. We can't see deeply. We can't see integrally. So we can't understand what it is that the divine would mean by investing itself in that which seems to limit its own being. And yet, as he says, the mystery of the universe must have a divine sense to the divine. And that we have to penetrate. So how do we achieve that? But before achieving it yogically, we have to understand all that we can philosophically about this question. So he comes back to this idea about the utter nature of the universe, and is it drawn from reality, or is it drawn from something that is elusive, something that is deceptive, something that is a misconfiguration of a deeper truth, or what might it be? So we pick it up with this next paragraph. If the reality alone exists, and all is the reality, the world also cannot be excluded from that reality. The universe is real. If it does not reveal to us in its forms and powers the reality that it is, if it seems only a persistent and yet changing movement in space and time, this must be not because it is unreal or because it is not at all that, but because it is a progressive self-expression, a manifestation, an evolving self-development of that in time, which our consciousness cannot yet see in its total or its essential significance. In this sense, we can say that it is that and not that, because it does not disclose all the reality through any form or some of its forms of self-expression. But still, all its forms are forms of the substance and being of that reality. So the universe is a real and advancing expression of the divine's own being. He continues, all finites are in their spiritual essence, the infinite. And if we look deep enough into them, manifest to intuition the identical and infinite. So if we deepen our insight, our vision through the practice of yoga, and can come into oneness with the infinite, then we can perceive that infinite behind each finite form. It isn't that the infinite has gone anywhere. It invests itself absolutely in every finite aspect of its own being. So the whole of the infinite is available in any finite. And in all of them together, again, the infinite is available, present, self-aware, not lost. This is available to our gathering spiritual experience. He continues, it is contended, indeed, that the universe cannot be a manifestation because the reality has no need of manifestation, since it is forever manifest to itself. But so, equally, it can be said that the reality has no need of self-illusion or illusion of any kind, no need to create a mayic universe. Well, again, let's back up and remember that to make something manifest is to make it clear. It isn't to create it out of nothing. It is to bring something that was in some profundity of being to the front. That's what being manifest means. And if the divine has no need to manifest itself, still, the other side of that argument, that what seems to be manifestation would be an illusion, well, the divine has no need to illude, to trick itself. It has no need to play a game with itself and to foist upon its own being that which is a fiction. The divine may not need to move, but it surely doesn't have any need to delude itself either. And when he says a mayic universe, remember, he is not using the term in its Vedic sense here, but in its Advaitic sense. The idea that the power of Maya would create a specious illusory universe, not simply measure the infinite into a finite compressed form for reasons of its own, but that what it would be presenting would be in some way a falsification of its nature, its own being. So we continue. The absolute can have no need of anything, but still there can be, not coercive of its freedom, not binding on it, but an expression of its self-force, the result of its will to become, an imperative of a supreme self-effectuating force, a necessity of self-creation born of the power of the absolute to see itself in time. So an imperative is a command. So this is a being with an innate consciousness, with the capacity through its own will or force to express itself. To express itself not only in finite fields or forms, but in the play and the unrolling of time. He continues, this imperative represents itself to us as a will to create, a will of self-expression, but it may be better represented as a force of being of the absolute, which displays itself as a power of itself in action. If the absolute is self-evident to itself in eternal timelessness, it can also be self-manifest to itself in eternal motion of time. Even if the universe is only a phenomenal reality, still it is a manifestation or phenomenon of Brahman. For since all is Brahman, phenomenon and manifestation must be the same thing. The imputation of unreality is a superfluous conception, otios, and unnecessarily embarrassing, since whatever distinction is needed is already there in the concept of time and the timeless eternal and the concept of manifestation. So here again, There is a connotation that there is an eternal recurrence, that the divine has the capacity from eternity to express itself again and again in the fields of time and space. And the phenomenon would represent eternity in the play of time. And all is Brahman. Unreality, then, if all is Brahman, is an unnecessary concept. It's superfluous, a word that means beyond what is necessary. And it's otios, which is another wonderful term, used more in the 19th than the 20th and the 21st century, meaning what is indolent, what is idle. The one thing that can be described as an unreal reality is our individual sense of separativeness and the conception of the finite as a self-existent object in the infinite. This is a core truth of Buddhism. Let's not mistake its import, but the idea that an individual exists in a vacuum and apart from all else is a fiction of philosophy. It cannot be. This conception, he writes, this sense, are pragmatically necessary for the operations of the surface individuality and are effective and justified by their effects. They are therefore real to its finite reason and finite self-experience. But once we step back from the finite consciousness into the consciousness of the essential and infinite, from the apparent to the true person, the finite or the individual still exists, but as being and power and manifestation of the infinite. It has no independent or separate reality. Individual independence, entire separativeness, are not necessary for individual reality, do not constitute it. On the other hand, the disappearance of these finite forms of the manifestation is evidently a factor in the problem, but does not by itself convict them of unreality. The disappearance may be only a withdrawal from manifestation. Just as if the universe can be withdrawn into Brahman and reasserted through the power of its will and force, so too the individual can be inserted into the universe as a living, viable form, and then withdrawn from that manifestation. It doesn't mean it goes out of being, only it is not manifest, it is not clear to the view any longer. He continues, the cosmic manifestation of the timeless takes place in the successions of time. Its forms must therefore be temporary in their appearance on the surface, but they are eternal in their essential power of manifestation, for they are held always implicit and potential in the essence of things and in the essential consciousness from which they emerge. Timeless consciousness can always turn their abiding potentiality into terms of time actuality. So forms are permanently potentialized within the divine being and can be reasserted cyclically, if that is the will. We've seen this argument before. He continues, the world would be unreal only if itself and its forms were images without substance of being. figments of consciousness presented to itself by the reality as pure figments and then abolished forever. But if manifestation or the power of manifestation is eternal, if all is the being of Brahman, the reality, then this unreality or illusoriness cannot be the fundamental character of things or of the cosmos in which they make their appearance. So he has crushed the argument of illusion. Illude, again, to trick, to play, from the Latin illudere, illusion, a false or deceptive appearance, the universe cannot be. If all that exists can only be part of the one reality, then if it exists, even in limited form, it shares in that reality and is not illusory. May be compressed, may be finite, but has the entirety of the infinite being behind it. So he continues, a theory of Maya, in the sense of illusion or the unreality of cosmic existence, creates more difficulties than it solves. It does not really solve the problem of existence, but rather renders it forever insoluble. For whether Maya be an unreality or a non-real reality, the ultimate effects of the theory carry in them a devastating simplicity of nullification. That's if we granted them their part of the argument. Of course, he rejects this interpretation of what Maya is. He continues, ourselves and the universe fade away into nothingness, or else keep for a time only a truth which is little better than a fiction. In the thesis of the pure unreality of Maya, all experience, all knowledge, as well as all ignorance, the knowledge that frees us no less than the ignorance that binds us, world acceptance and world refusal are two sides of an illusion, for there is nothing to accept or refuse, nobody to accept or refuse it. All the time, it was only the immutable, superconscient reality that it all existed. The bondage and release were only appearances, not a reality. All attachment to world existence is an illusion. But the call for liberation is also a circumstance of the illusion. It is something that was created in Maya, which by its liberation is extinguished in Maya. But this nullification cannot be compelled to stop short in its devastating advance at the boundary fixed for it by a spiritual illusionism. For if all other experiences of the individual consciousness in the universe are illusions, then what guarantee is there that its spiritual experiences are not illusions, including even its absorbed self-experience of the Supreme Self, which is conceded to us as utterly real? For if cosmos is untrue, our experience of the cosmic consciousness, of the universal self, of Brahman as all these beings, or as the self of all these beings, the one in all in the one, has no secure foundation, since it reposes in one of its terms on an illusion, on a construction of Maya. In other words, if their argument is right, then our liberation might be wrong. We don't really exist to be liberated. Liberation of a fiction into a fiction? We don't know which side is fictional. That term, he writes, the cosmic term, has to crumble. For all these beings which we saw as the Brahman were illusions. Then what is our assurance of our experience of the other term, the pure self, the silent, static, or absolute reality, since that too comes to us in a mind molded of delusion and formed in a body created by an illusion. Both world and its beings, and the being of our own perceiving self, can be resolved into fictional status if we accept this line of reasoning. He continues, an overwhelming, self-evident convincingness, an experience of absolute authenticity in the realization or experience is not an unanswerable proof of soul reality or soul finality. For other spiritual experiences, such as that of the omnipresent divine person, Lord of a real universe, have the same convincing, authentic, and final character. It is open to the intellect, which has once arrived at the conviction of the unreality of all other things, to take a farther step and deny the reality of self and of all existence. The Buddhists took this last step and refused reality to the self on the ground that it was, as much as the rest, a construction of the mind. They cut not only God, but the eternal self and impersonal Brahman out of the picture. An uncompromising theory of illusion solves no problem of our existence. It only cuts the problem out for the individual by showing him a way of exit. In its extreme form and effect, our being and its action become null and without sanction. Its experience, aspiration, endeavor lose their significance. All the one incommunicable, relationless truth accepted and the turning away to it become equated with illusion of being, are part of a universal illusion and themselves illusion. God and ourselves and the universe become myths of Maya. For God is only a reflection of Brahman in Maya. Ourselves are only a reflection of Brahman in illusory individuality. The world is only an imposition on the Brahman's incommunicable self-existence. So to sum up, the illusionistic theory offers us nothing. We and the world and the divine may not exist, so why bother? Why should we labor for liberation? Why should we regard anything as real if even our profoundest experiences can only be the signature of illusion? He continues, because this clearly is not his position. There is a less drastic nullification if a certain reality is admitted for the being, even within the illusion, a certain validity for the experience and knowledge by which we grow into the spirit. But this is only if the temporal has a valid reality and the experience in it has a real validity. And in that case, what we are in front of is not an illusion taking the unreal for real, but an ignorance misapprehending the real. So you can see what he's done in these last couple of paragraphs is rehearse the two worldviews which could regard the universe as being an illusion in some way. The first is sheerly the subjective positing of a universe upon a real Brahman. And so that we fall away from when we gain knowledge, if there is knowledge. The second possibility is that there is some kind of relative reality in our apperception of the universe that he's dealing with here. But it requires us, again, to make a distinction between ignorance and illusion. Illusion is a falsification of being. Ignorance is a limited power of knowledge It is not absolute absence of knowledge, but it is restricted knowledge. So what it knows is not the entirety, but a partiality of what it views. And ignorance has the capacity to outgrow itself and to become true knowledge. But an illusion has no real existence, and so can never really be free, because it isn't there. Otherwise, he writes, if the beings of whom Brahman is the self are illusory, its selfhood is not valid. It is part of an illusion. The experience of self is also an illusion. The experience, I am that, is vitiated by an ignorant conception, for there is no I, only that. The experience, I am he, is doubly ignorant, for it assumes a conscious eternal, a lord of the universe, a cosmic being. But there can be no such thing if there is no reality in the universe. It's the experience, I am that. Aham Brahmasmi, one of the Mahavakyas of the Upanishads. Brihadaranyaka 1:4:10. The experience, I am he, soham. The Isha Upanishad, verse 16. Those are two of the great statements of the Upanishads recognized across the Vedantic tradition. The other two Mahavakyas, which are commonly cited, are Prajnanam Brahman. Brahman is that great knowledge. Or Ayam Atma Brahma, which is I am that eternal, which is Brahman. The first is from the Aitareya Upanishad 3:3, and the last from the Mandukya Upanishad 1:2. He continues, a real solution of existence can only stand upon a truth that accounts for our existence and world existence, reconciles their truth, their right relation, and the truth of their relation to whatever transcendent reality is the source of everything. But this implies some reality of individual and cosmos, some true relation of the one existence and all existences, of relative experience and of the absolute. So again, he's presenting his own solution in a tight form here, that there is a transcendent reality which configures itself as cosmos and as individual, both of them innately connected, not only to each other, not only is the individual innately connected to the all, which is a representation of the cosmic being, but both depend upon that transcendence, which is beyond time. Universe is a play in time and in a multitude of forms, and the forms are real and time is real, but forms and time emerge out of the timeless being of that one. Oneness is never abrogated or annulled in the manifestation of the many, and the individual among those many is real, is an expression of singularity, just as the one is an expression of singularity. So the one and the all are expressed in the many, and the one and the all are expressed in each. The theory of illusion cuts the knot of the world problem. It does not disentangle it. This is a reference back to Alexander cutting the Gordian knot, the famous Greek problem, which is, can anybody untie this? Alexander strides up and doesn't try to untie it, takes his sword and cuts it in two. It is not the solution. Destruction is not the solution to the riddle. He continues, it is an escape, not a solution. A flight of the spirit is not a sufficient victory for the being embodied in this world of the becoming. It affects a separation from nature, not a liberation and fulfillment of our nature. This eventual outcome satisfies only one element, sublimates only one impulse of our being. It leaves the rest out in the cold to perish in the twilight of the unreal reality of Maya. Here he does not deny the right of the inmost being in us to soar out and to experience the eternity. But what about the rest of us which is invested in the world? That too demands a solution, not an extrication, but a fulfillment. As in science, so in metaphysical thought, that general and ultimate solution is likely to be the best, which includes and accounts for all, so that each truth of experience takes its place in the whole. That knowledge is likely to be the highest knowledge, which illumines, integralizes, harmonizes the significance of all knowledge, and accounts for, finds the basic and one might almost say the justifying reason of our ignorance and illusion, while it cures them. This is the supreme experience, which gathers all experience in the truth of a supreme and all-reconciling oneness. Illusionism unifies by elimination. It deprives all knowledge and experience except the one supreme merger of reality and significance. So to illusionism, the only answer is to cancel out our participation in the universe, in individuality, and merge ourselves into that timeless one single being. But the justifying reason of going through the importation through ignorance into this universe is to find the richness and the cause which underlie this manifestation. The cause of the cosmos, the cause of our individuation within it, and the richness of being that can emerge from our multifarious experience in the cosmos. That is a fulfillment of the universe, not a cancellation of it. He continues, but this debate belongs to the domain of the pure reason. And the final test of truths of this order is not reason, but spiritual illumination verified by abiding fact of spirit. So the exaltation here of experience as a final knowledge over the power of reason. Reason may be one of the pramanas, methods of advancement towards knowledge, but it is experience, anubhava, which gives us that thing essentially and veridically. A single decisive spiritual experience may undo a whole edifice of reasonings and conclusions erected by the logical intelligence. And if I might be permitted an aside, of course, if you've studied theology, you know how the great Thomas Aquinas in the Catholic tradition and what a powerful impact he's had on theology. But at the end of his life, he had a shattering spiritual experience that took him beyond all his logic. And it left him bereft. He said, I have had an experience that has destroyed all my illusions, all my reasonings, my theology as if nothing before the grandeur of that. Back to Sri Aurobindo. He writes here, the theory of illusionism is an occupation of a very solid ground, for although it is in itself no more than a mental formulation, the experience it formulates into a philosophy accompanies a most powerful and apparently final spiritual realization. So what gives this argument force that Shankara presents is a powerful spiritual realization, no doubt. Let's look at it more closely. It comes upon us, he writes, with a great force of awakening to reality when the thought is stilled, when the mind withdraws from its constructions, when we pass into a pure selfhood void of all sense of individuality, empty of all cosmic contents. If the spiritualized mind then looks at individual and cosmos, they may well seem to it to be an illusion, a scheme of names and figures and movements falsely imposed on the sole reality of the self-existent. This is a transference into prose of Sri Aurobindo's own experience of Brahmic Nirvana in 1908. Or even the sense of self becomes inadequate. Both knowledge and ignorance disappear into sheer consciousness, and consciousness is plunged into a trance of pure, superconscient existence. Or even existence ends by becoming too limiting a name for that which abides solely forever. There is only a timeless eternal, a spaceless infinite, the utterness of the absolute, a nameless peace, an overwhelming, single, objectless ecstasy. This is the unknowable, of which he has written in earlier chapters. There can certainly be no doubt of the validity, complete within itself, of this experience. There can be no denial of the overwhelming, decisive convincingness, ekatma pratyaya saram, with which this realization seizes the consciousness of the spiritual seeker. Interesting, he didn't translate that. It means, whose substance is the certitude of one self. That's from the Mandukya Upanishad, verse 7. But still, all spiritual experience is experience of the infinite, and it takes a multitude of directions. Some of them, and not this alone, are so close to the divine and the absolute, so penetrated with the reality of its presence or with the ineffable peace and power of the liberation from all that is less than it, that they carry with them this overwhelming sense of finality, complete and decisive. There are 100 ways of approaching the supreme reality, and as is the nature of the way taken, so will be the nature of the ultimate experience by which one passes into that which is ineffable, that of which no report can be given to the mind or expressed by any utterance. This is a cautionary reminder against excluding any of the great spiritual experiences. They must all be integrated and seen within the context of that great one. He continues, all these definitive culminations may be regarded as penultimates of the one ultimate. They are steps by which the soul crosses the limits of mind into the absolute. Is then This realization of passing into a pure, immobile self-existence, or this nirvana of the individual and the universe, one among these penultimates, or is it itself the final and absolute realization, which is at the end of every journey and transcends and eliminates all lesser experiences? It claims to stand behind and supersede, to sublate, and to eliminate every other knowledge. If that is really so, then its finality must be accepted as conclusive. To sublate means to resolve in a higher unity. To supersede means to sit above, like udasinata, to be seated above, or to refrain from. But is this a pretense? Is this really the final experience which cancels out all others? Sri Aurobindo continues, but against this pretension, it has been claimed that it is possible to travel beyond by a greater negation or a greater affirmation, to extinguish self in non-being, or to pass through the double experience of cosmic consciousness and nirvana of world consciousness in the one existence to a greater divine union and unity, which holds both these realizations in its vast integral reality. We referred just a paragraph ago, well, actually a few lines ago, it's the same paragraph, to his experience in 1908. His experience continued to develop and became world-including, a vision which saw Vasudeva, the indwelling universal in all things, which greatened his experience from 1908 all the way to 1914, arriving at a picture, a view, an experience of an integral divinity, which is transcendent, which is universal, which is individual, which is not merely impersonal, but which is also the great person, all at once, without one canceling the other, each completing the other. So again, the philosophy which he is unrolling here is founded on his own experience, anubhava, but a completing experience. It is said that beyond the duality and the non-duality, there is that in which both are held together and find their truth in a truth which is beyond them. This is the Bhagavad Gita echoing. A consummating experience which proceeds by the exceeding and elimination of all other possible but lesser experiences is, as a step towards the absolute, admissible. A supreme experience which affirms and includes the truth of all spiritual experience gives to each its own absolute, integralizes all knowledge and experience in a supreme reality, might be the one step farther that is at once a largest illuminating and transforming truth of all things and a highest infinite transcendence. The Brahman, the supreme reality, is that which, being known, all is known. But in the illusionist solution, it is that which, being known, all becomes unreal and an incomprehensible mystery. In this other experience, the reality being known, all assumes its true significance, its truth to the eternal and absolute. And this was a reference to the Mundaka Upanishad 113. Now we are close to Sri Aurobindo's vision. He has written about his experience, and now I think in these next couple of weeks he'll make plain why he affirms cosmos. why he does not deny it. So I think we'll put our marks there for this evening and turn again to Savitri. We'll continue the passage that we were reading last time. We're still in the Book of Yoga, Book 7, Canto 6, Nirvana, and the all-negating Absolute. In that absolute stillness, bare and formidable, there was glimpsed an all-negating void supreme that claimed its mystic nihil's sovereign right to cancel nature and deny the soul. Even the nude sense of self grew pale and thin, impersonal, signless, featureless, void of forms. A blank, pure consciousness had replaced the mind. Her spirit seemed the substance of a name, the world, a pictured symbol drawn on self, a dream of images, a dream of sounds, built up the semblance of a universe, or lent to spirit the appearance of a world. This was self-seeing. In that intolerant hush, no notion and no concept could take shape. There was no sense to frame the figure of things. A sheer self-sight was there. No thought arose. Emotion slept deep down in the still heart, or lay buried in a cemetery of peace. All feelings seemed quiescent, calm, or dead, as if the heartstrings rent could work no more, and joy and grief could never rise again. The heart beat on with an unconscious rhythm, but no response came from it and no cry. Vain was the provocation of events. Nothing within answered an outside touch. No nerve was stirred and no reaction rose. Yet still her body saw and moved and spoke. It understood without the aid of thought. It said whatever needed to be said. It did whatever needed to be done. There was no person there behind the act, no mind that chose or passed the fitting word. All wrought like an unerring, apt machine. As if continuing old habitual turns, and pushed by an old unexhausted force, the engine did the work for which it was made. Her consciousness looked on and took no part. All it upheld, in nothing had a share. There was no strong initiator will, an incoherence crossing a firm void slipped into an order of related chance. We'll continue on next time. Namaste, Jai Ma.